call them change makers.
Call them rule breakers.
We call them redefiners.
Join us in conversation with daring leaders who are creating extraordinary impact and driving change from around the globe.
Each episode gives you a fresh perspective on your leadership and career journey. I'm Hoda Tahoon, a leadership advisor at Russell Reynolds.
I'm Clark Murphy, the former chief executive officer and a leadership advisor. And this is Redefiners.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Redefiners. I'm Hoda Tahoon.
And I'm Simon Kingston.
Simon, there's a lot happening in the world these days, and let's face it, it's not all good. In fact, I think the world has quite a bit of crisis going on. There are wars in the Ukraine and Gaza, increasing violence in Haiti, civil war in South Sudan, spreading conflict in Myanmar, ongoing conflict in the Congo, poverty in Afghanistan, violence in Burkina Faso, consecutive drought seasons, and growing conflict in Ethiopia. And that's just to name a few. And we can't forget the escalating impact of climate change and climate disasters on many countries around the world, many of which don't have the infrastructure nor the resources to actually deal with them on their own. So I don't mean to doom scroll here, but there's a lot that people need help with around the world today.
Hoda, that's right. There's no shortage of conflict. There's no shortage of injustice. And I think it's very easy for us to become paralyzed by a kind of gloom in the face of that list and the even longer one we could construct. And that's why for us it's so important to hear about people who choose to respond through action and through leadership and who guide some of the most important organizations that respond to that in partnership with other humanitarian organizations and in partnership with the private sector and civil society more widely.
And in fact, we have one of those incredible leaders with us today, don't we?
Certainly do. So our guest today on Redefiners is David Miliband. David is President and Chief Executive Officer of the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, and he oversees that organization's humanitarian relief operations in more than 50 of the conflict-affected countries, that some of which you've just described, and its work with displaced peoples and refugees and its assistance programs in 29 US states. Through its work, the IRC and partners has helped more than 33 million people in some of those countries. And we'll hear a little bit about that work from David shortly. But prior to leading IRC, David held a range of senior posts in British government and perhaps most famously was Foreign Secretary of the UK from 2007, a post he took on aged just 41.
David, welcome to Redefiners.
Thank you, Hoda. Thank you, Simon. Good to be with you.
Okay, so let's just get this out of the way, David. Is the world just doomed? Please tell us that there's more hope and hope out there in general.
No, of course the world's not doomed. It's the end of the world is the end of the world, and that's not on the horizon. In fact, the world has more resources to do more good than at any time in human history, and that makes it all the more inexcusable. So many fellow citizens around the world are consumed by extreme poverty. Actually, what's happening, it's interesting, this century, the number of people in extreme poverty in stable states has been going down, but extreme poverty in fragile and conflict states is going up. And those conflict states certainly are affected by the climate crisis that you referenced, Hoda. These are climate vulnerable countries that are also the lowest investors in climate resilience because they're some of the poorest countries in the world. And there are 300 million people in humanitarian need around the world. There are 110 million people who are refugees or internally displaced around the world. And so this is a moment of generalized prosperity, albeit with a lot of insecurity, but also acute, really acute threats to lives and livelihoods for people who are unlucky enough to be born in some of the countries that you mention. And it's the job of the International Rescue Committee to help people survive, to help them recover, and to help them to gain control of their futures using the resources that are in such evidence around the world.
And we're going to jump into listening to you talk about some of the IRC's work in a second. But David, just before that, let's talk about you and about why you were so motivated to do this kind of work. It's well known that both of your parents were themselves refugees who were displaced from continental Europe to Britain during and after the Second World War. For you growing up, how large did that fact loom?
not very large. I think like many refugee families, there's a choice. People can really be so consumed by the past that they can't escape it, or they can try and protect their children from what they went through. So my dad came to the UK in 1940. He did a year of high school and then went to qualified for the LSC, London School of Economics. He went into the Navy. In a way, he had a sort of a slightly heroic war. Both of his parents survived the war, his dad with him in the UK, his mother and his sister in Belgium, sheltered by a Catholic family. It's worth saying 40-plus members of my father's family were killed in concentration camps. So his most immediate family survived, but his wider family didn't. My mother, her father was sent to Auschwitz and then was killed in another concentration camp. And she spent the war in hiding in Poland. They met in London in the 1950s, and I think they didn't want to live in the past. They knew about the past that they had escaped and survived, but they, I think, sought to offer the security that they never had to their children. And so I was not brought up being told, look how lucky you are, you couldn't be here, just imagine what it was like to be like us. I think there was a moral imperative that was imbued, which was, if you can make a difference, you should, and if you don't, it's a waste. I think maybe as one gets older, one has a sense that you've got debts to repay.
Yeah.
And I certainly, when I applied for the job as CEO of the IRC, I said I was interested in the job because I liked big problems. I was interested in the job because the IRC was a bit of a sleeping giant, but also because my parents had been refugees, and by helping people around the world, I was in some way repaying a debt that my parents owed to people who had saved their lives. But I wouldn't want to overclaim for it.
So David, on that point, this ties in so beautifully with the mission of the IRC, which is to help people affected by humanitarian crisis to survive, recover, and rebuild their lives very much in the same way that your family did and your parents did. And you're clearly very busy with the various global crises around the world these days. For our listeners who aren't as familiar with the IRC, could you give us a quick overview of what the organization does and whom you serve?
Yeah, we're a humanitarian agency that was founded by Albert Einstein. People shouldn't forget that. Once you tell them that, they think, wow. We were founded by Einstein in the 30s. And there's an interesting story, really, which is that he was in touch with Eleanor Roosevelt and through her, President Roosevelt. But he was so frustrated that governments were not offering sanctuary for Jews and other oppressed minorities in Europe in the 1930s that he helped found the IRC. Our first employee was a man called Varian Fry, who set up a safe house in Marseille in 1940 in Nazi-occupied France. And 2,000 people were issued with fake passports to help them get out of Nazi-occupied France, including Marc Chagall. I mean, he survived thanks to the IRC. Today, we're a global international humanitarian agency, and we're unique in a number of ways. First of all, we have a very clear mission that is only focused on people who are in poverty because of conflict and disaster. Secondly, we're a major force of evidence making and innovation. We're 3% of the humanitarian sector, but 30% of all the impact evaluations about what actually works. Thirdly, we are an international humanitarian agency that helps people in Sudan, in Gaza, in South Sudan, in Afghanistan, but we're also a refugee resettlement agency in America, Germany, and the UK. We're also fast growing. We've grown from being a $450 million organization 10 years ago to now being a $1.6 billion a year organization. So we try and have the culture of a startup, but the impact of a big business, a big organization. And then the final point I think that's worth making about our work is that the 33 million people that we helped, that Simon referenced in the interim, that was last year. So we helped 33 million people in the space of a year. And within that, about 45% of our international work is in health, another 15% is in education, another 15% in economic livelihoods, another maybe 20% in child and women's protection, because children and women and girls are especially vulnerable in humanitarian crises. And maybe the final thing, just to round it out, when I arrived, we were an organization dedicated to helping refugees and others. And I didn't like the idea of anyone being an other. So we said we want to help people whose lives are shattered by conflict and disaster. And today, I would guess about 20% of our clients and we use that word advisedly, 20% of our clients are in conflict. So in Gaza, in Sudan, about another 25% or so are maybe even, 25 to 30% are internally displaced. So in other words, they're refugees in their own country. So 1.5 million people in northwest Syria have been driven there by the course of the civil war. They're internally displaced. Another 25% or so are refugees or asylum seekers. So they've actually crossed a border. So they're in Jordan or Lebanon in the case of Syrian refugees. And then 20% are host populations. One important point is that you've got to help people who are driven out by conflict. But if 100,000 people arrive in your town, and your town is 100,000 people, which it is in the case of Mafraq in northern Jordan, that's a pretty big shock to your system. And you've got to help the host population as well. So sorry if that's a long answer, but that tries to give a sense of what we're about.
And David, you've talked about a number of different client groups, different geographies, different conflicts. Such as any large organization, there's going to be a limited amount of money, a resource, and people who can actually service and provide the support that's going to be needed. How do you prioritize how the resources are going to be allocated? And how, from your perspective as a leader, are you deciding on what to take on?
Well, I hope we're a bit less underfunded as a result of this podcast. So needless to say, since I've lived in New York for 10 years, I'm less shy about fundraising. But it's an important question. About $1 billion of our revenues come from governments. And the choice for us then is whether we apply for a grant. So if there a grant is applied in Pakistan or for Yemen or for Gaza, we have to decide to apply for it. It's not my money. We have quite strict entry and exit criteria to make sure that we don't suffer from the mission creep that a lot of NGOs do suffer from. So if a project is not helping victims of crisis or disaster, if there isn't extreme poverty and vulnerability, or if someone else is already placed doing the job, we don't apply. We have to be the right people there. So the choice about those grants is whether we go for them, not where I put them. I'm not sitting here with $1.5 billion. When it comes to the private money, corporation and foundation money is often restricted as well. All to say that the amount of unrestricted revenue that we have is only about $300 million. You know, I'm quite proud that when I arrived, we spent 0.5% a year on IT. Now we spend 3% of $1.5 billion on IT. But that choice meant when COVID hit, we were able to continue our operations rather than have them break down. But it costs. All to say, at the end of the day, how much money is available for dispensation into programs, it's more limited than the $1.5 billion. Within that, we obviously have to prioritize survival. So life and death interventions in Gaza or in Sudan. Sudan came top of our emergency watch list, 25 million people in humanitarian need in Sudan. South Sudan is number three because they've got 500,000 refugees. Survival comes top, but I'm also very committed to the idea that if the humanitarian sector just chases its tail, if it neglects innovation, it's never going to succeed. So we try to work for the medium term, not just the short term. I think that's part of what it means to be strategic. And we'll come back to this because I'm a great opponent of the idea that culture eats strategy for lunch. And I'm a great opponent of the idea that strategy is only something for corporate boardrooms, not for NGOs. I think good strategy is about what you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it. And my view is that we're stronger for being a strategy-led organization.
And just on that, David, I mean, a couple of your answers have already given a sense of the complexity, both the complexity of the different constituencies and the legitimately different interests that they have in the places that you're serving, but also the range of organizations and sectors with whom you have to engage, state actors, non-state actors, business. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned about partnership with partners whose motives and whose definitions of success are different to yours? I mean, how do you think about that engagement with them?
We've become a more mature partner of our partners in the last 10 years. And we're mature in some ways in being less beholden to them, some of them, being a bit more willing to say no, which I think is important. But we've also, I think, become much more engaging of our local partners. And one of the things I said 10 years ago was that accountability in the humanitarian sector often flows upwards to donors rather than downwards to clients and partners locally. And we've tried to change that. One example is that on the strategy map that you can see over my right shoulder, for those who are watching this rather than listening on podcasts, I mean, in the middle of that diamond is the word clients. And that's for a reason. It's not just a bit of rhetoric. It's actually the overarching target of our work. And one way in which that has reflects itself is that almost all of our country programs now do customer satisfaction surveys in a serious way and engage their customers. So our first partners are our clients. But secondly, there's a big drive in the NGO sector now for more quote-unquote localization. Often that's talked about in terms of quote-unquote building capacity. We don't talk about it in that way. We think that's rather a patronizing way to think about partnering with local actors. We talk about a marriage of expertise. We do have expertise in different contexts. We do have research expertise. We do have expertise in navigating compliance. But we may not be experts when it comes to the local power structures. We may not be the experts when it comes to the local power dynamics. We may not be the experts when it comes to local context. And that's important, even though 99, 97% of our employees are hired locally. You've got a marriage of expertise if you can join the heft and the experience of a global NGO with established local NGOs. And I mean, that's happening in Gaza today, for example.
We touched on this in a couple of ways already, but one of the many deficits as well as resource in the context that you're describing is trust. And increasingly, we're told we live in a post-truth world in many of the polities with which we might expect to engage. How do you build trust both with your clients and with the range of partners that we've talked about?
Well, I want to give a very simple answer to that, which is not intended to be glib. It's to do what we say. Mm. The biggest eroder of trust is whether what you say and what you do are not in line. And so when I say we want to treat our partners as experts who we are in alliance with, the tell is whether or not you do that. When I say that we want to ask our clients what they think and we want them to be able to report when things are wrong, if they don't, or if we don't react properly or we don't allow them to, then that's the trust eroder. Obviously, in our sector, there's a danger that anyone who gets help from us is just incredibly grateful for any help. We try not to allow that to become a sort of lowering of expectations, and we try and set high aspirations for the way we work and the quality of what we do and the measurement of what we do. But in the end, the biggest eroder of trust is whether words and deeds are aligned or misaligned. And that's how we build trust. And one interesting point is that many non-state actors who are in control of the places that we work, they don't want to get on the wrong side of their client populations. And we find that when our services are threatened by non-state actors, our clients and their constituents don't like it. And that's quite a good tell about whether or not we're doing well. But there's no room to be complacent. I always say that every part of any organization I'm part of, I want it to be either excellent or improving or both.
The other element of partnership with private sector actors, I'm kind of interested in, against that backdrop of the need to sustain trust at times when there is a deficit in it elsewhere, what role you see business leaders playing in helping to address some of the challenges you've described, both as providers of resource, but also as providers of alliances of actors?
I'm a big believer that at times when governments are in retreat, which is the time we're living in, governments are in retreat from all sorts of big problems, businesses and NGOs have to step up. And if possible, they have to step up together. But in order to do so, they have to be honest with each other. Too many pressures on NGOs are to say thank you, thank you, thank you for a bespoke small program that's got a big bit of PR associated with it. We try and avoid that because it's not honest. I think that in the main, corporate social responsibility is nowhere near enough focused on corporate social results. And we're a big proponent of results, not just responsibility. Our best corporate partnerships are about more than a check. They're about exchange of skills, for example, to help with our cybersecurity. They're about exchange of personnel, for example, secondments into our strategy unit. They are about employee giving. They're about corporate voice, as well as about financing for an NGO. And that's our best corporate alliances have those kind of 360-degree qualities.
And just on that point about corporate voice, how far can it legitimately go?
Well, I think legitimately it can go a long way. The question whether wisely is a slightly different way of putting it. I think that the model I've set up where humanitarian concern is impartial, independent, neutral, which are the humanitarian principles alongside humanity, is something that should be unifying rather than dividing. But you have to do it before the disaster, not after. Because if you do it after, there's more chance you'll get accused of taking sides. Whereas if you've established a strategic position that you care about the rest of the world, not just yourself, you care especially about those most vulnerable, not just anyone, and you're building relationships with trusted NGOs who have the infrastructure and the transparency so that you know what's happening with your money and your skills and your voice, then I think you're in a much stronger position when the inevitable squalls come. I think if you're chasing the agenda, you're in a mess.
We'll be right back with David Miliband, but first, we'll hear from Dee Simons, a managing director in our London office, who will highlight why trust is such a critical component of an effective team.
Creating an environment of trust is one of the most important things that you can do as a leader. When trust is present, it can be an indicator of long-term organizational success. But we found that trust is broken at the top of many organizations. In fact, our research found that only 22% of C-suite leaders actually trust their own team. So, how can you address the trust deficits within your top team? Fixing it won't happen overnight. It requires everyone to play a role. But there are certain actions that a CEO can take to build trust in their C-suite. Firstly, foster inclusivity and transparency. Share information with the entire C-suite, not just a select few. When everybody feels that they're treated the same, it reduces competition and cultivates trust. Secondly, avoid command and control leadership. Instead, think about how you serve your organization and the people who you lead. Thirdly, be consistent. Make sure that you say what you mean and you do what you say. And fourthly, hire wide T-shaped leaders. These are leaders who have the ability and the willingness to consider how decisions impact the wider business context and connect to the strategy. To learn more about the actions you can take to build up stores of this essential leadership capital in your top team, click the link to the article in the show notes or visit russellreynolds.com.
And now, back to our conversation with David.
David, you talked quite a bit about the global purview that you have, but also that, you know, marriage of expertise at the local level. And right now, there's a trend towards deglobalization that we think will continue to accelerate, particularly as 2024 is set to be a record year for global elections around the world. I think there are 70 national elections and almost half of the world's population voting on their country's leader this year. How should leaders navigate in a world where the predictable flight paths of globalization for business may not be so clear going forward?
The simple answer is that if business wants to continue to enjoy the benefits of globalization, it has to share the burdens. And the truth is, too much of globalization has gone to too few, and it won't be protected if it continues to go to too few. Now, just in the spirit of someone who went to university in the 1980s, the first thing you're taught is to challenge the question. And of course, it's not actually the case that there's much deglobalization at the moment. There's some friendshoring going on. There's some protectionism going on. There's some nationalism going on. Mm-hmm. But actually, the global economy is massively more integrated than it was 30 years ago. And the reductions in integration are limited compared to the amount of integration that's happened. Beyond the economic sphere, the telephone, the so-called telephone, the smart device that more and more people, tens of millions of more people have every week of the year, is actually connecting the world culturally. The world is more globalized rather than less every week because more people can see more of what's going on elsewhere in the world than they did before. So first point to make, let's just be careful. It's not clear to me that this will be an era of deglobalization. It may not be an era of more economic globalization. It may be an era of more protectionism. It may be an era of shorter supply chains. It may be an era of regionalization. But I think we have to be careful. Secondly, though, the truth about the global risks we face, climate risks, economic risks, perhaps even nuclear risks, health risks, pandemic risks, they are domestic policy, not just foreign policy. And those problems will come crashing through your front door if they're not managed and addressed. And that's the argument that has to be made. Now, it can only be made if the wealthiest parts of the world, which isn't just the political West, by the way, I mean, there's wealth elsewhere than the political West, those problems can only be addressed if there is responsibility on the part of those that have the most. And that, I think, is an important part of the argument. At the moment, there's a backlash against Western countries for the mismanagement of globalization since 1990, in some ways deserved. But it's going to be all those who have power and influence who are going to be on the hook for the next 30 years.
David, you mentioned there the impact of climate change. Can we talk a little bit about how you're seeing those manifest themselves for the clients that IRC serves and reflect perhaps on how your program has had to change to meet it?
I talk about it as the climate crisis rather than climate change, not just to make a debating point, but to speak to a reality that we face. I'm not sure I'm going to get this quite right, but I was in South Sudan 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago, and someone said that Africa has twice the change in temperature of the rest of the world, and South Sudan has twice the African change in temperature, which is pretty striking. So our clients are living with the direct consequences of the climate crisis, which is, of course, not just an average rise in the global temperature and all that goes with it for agriculture. It's also the fact that an average rise in the global temperature means more extreme weather events. So they're dealing with direct secular rise in temperature. They're dealing with more extreme weather events. They're dealing with the fact that climate crisis is a contributor to conflict because of the way it exacerbates resource stress. There's also the potential for climate crisis to be a driver of people movement for economic reasons, not just disaster-related reasons. So we're dealing with the consequences of the climate crisis today on livelihoods, on mobility. Mainly, it's worth saying, mobility within countries. Right? I don't talk about climate refugees, because at the moment, there aren't that many direct climate refugees. People are internally displaced rather than crossing borders as a result. And we're having to change our programming in some obvious areas like agricultural livelihoods. We've got a very interesting seed strengthening program in northeast Syria and in Pakistan, but also some less obvious ways, the way the climate crisis is interrupting education. There was a story last week about how, sorry to mention South Sudan again, but it happened to be in the news, schools are closing because of the heat, 45 degrees heat.
Wow.
So we're dealing with the consequences and trying to react in our programs. It's not just that the places we work are more exposed to the climate crisis. There's a linear relationship between how poor you are and how little you spend on climate resilience. So there's a UNDP, United Nations Development Programme report, which shows that the poorer you are, the less you're spending on climate resilience, even if you're more exposed to it. And 14 of the top 20 countries on our emergency watch list are in the top quartile of climate vulnerability. So you can see they need climate investment. They're not getting it. So we've got a big engagement with the World Bank and the international financial institutions at the moment about what are the decision rules that should drive the flow of climate finance, not just 50% for adaptation, 50% for mitigation. When I was Environment Secretary 15 years ago, adaptation was seen as a sort of poor cousin because it meant you'd failed on mitigation. Well, we have failed on mitigation, so now you need to do adaptation and, by the way, loss and damage as well. 50% should go to adaptation. But within that adaptation, the fragile and conflict states need to get their share. And by the way, that means if you want to really reach people in need, you can't just work through governments because they're often combatants in the conflicts that we're dealing with.
David, you talked earlier on around women and girls being an essential client group. and a core focus for the IRC. The UN estimates that more than 600 million women and girls live in conflict-affected countries. And to that fact, they make up about two-thirds of IRC's clients, which is a massive, massive number. Talk to us, please, about why you focus on women and girls so much and how you tackle gender discrimination.
Well, we focus on women and girls because they're our clients, or they're the majority of our clients, and they face multiple inequalities. We actually say that to be a successful humanitarian organization, you have to be a feminist organization. That means that you have to take seriously the structural inequalities that affect women and girls in the communities in which we work and in the conflicts in which we work. We also have to take seriously the structural inequalities that women face in the humanitarian aid sector. And so we have a two-pronged approach. One prong is obviously internal, to make sure that we are ensuring that our female colleagues get all of the opportunities that their talents deserve, and that we are really zealous in making sure that sexual harassment, sexual discrimination is really prevented and, where it occurs, dealt with appropriately. But also in our programs, which means measuring the needs of women and girls properly, it means tuning programs to their needs properly. Very simple point. If you put a big sign up that says, come here for birth control, you're going to get a different access than if you just say health center. You're going to have less attacks and violence than if you don't have proper lighting where there are latrines. But also, and this is, I think, I don't want to say the most interesting, but very striking. If you just have social service programs for women and girls, but women, you'll achieve something. If you ally those social service programs with economic empowerment programs, you achieve more than double.
Wow.
And so we talk about women's protection and empowerment, not just gender-based violence, precisely for that reason. I think our village savings and loans programs, sort of credit unions, our female entrepreneurship programs, they have outsized impact.
David, Alistair Campbell, who, as some of our listeners will know, has a podcast of his own these days, used to call you brains when you led Tony Blair's policy unit. How intelligent is hope in a job like yours, given the sheer magnitude of the challenges?
I've probably disproved the label in the last 45 minutes. So
not at all, David.
Look, hope is not a strategy. Hope is a matter of temperament. And I think you can either fuel hope or drain hope. I gave a lecture in Cambridge in November where I tried to address the question I'm asked endlessly, which is, how do your teams stay hopeful or optimistic in the face of all the crisis they've faced? And I confessed, I give the same answer every time. I'll give the same answer to you, which is, if you look at the statistics, you get depressed. If you look at the people, you have hope. And that remains true. But I tried to then click down a bit more deeply about how, if hope is a renewable resource, how do you renew it? Mm. And I think three things are important in my experience leading the IRC in renewing hope. One is you have to have a bias to action. This is something that you referenced right at the beginning, Simon. I think action creates hope rather than hope creates action. Second point, I think you have to have a strategic orientation to embrace risk. And in all the talk of risk scorecards and all the rest of it, you've got to have a strategic orientation towards the embrace of risk. Otherwise, you're going to fail. We say in our innovation fund, we're proud that 40% of the projects fail. Because if you weren't failing in your innovation fund, you're not taking enough risk. You can't say that in government, or it's very hard to say that in government, but actually it's sensible. And then thirdly, you have to speak to universal values at a time when they're under attack. And we try to do that. Sometimes it's difficult, but I think it's very important that you speak to those values. And the humanitarian principles of neutrality and impartiality and independence, humanity, they actually give you a platform to do that. And that's the recipe that I've learned, if you like, in the time doing this job.
And people talk a lot about the resilience of leaders. Do those principles apply to you individually as well as to the IRC corporately?
So, yeah, I think if I was trapped in an organization that didn't have a bias to action, if I was trapped in an organization that had no risk appetite, and if I was trapped in an organization that didn't dare say boo to a goose, it would be much less satisfying. The truth is, I get hopeful in another way, which is learning. I think if you're not learning, you can't lead.
So it's rational optimism.
Well, I hope it's rational, but right. The definition of optimism is that it's not determined by an equation. I'm all in favor of rationality, but you can't measure optimism. I can't prove to you that it's 75% more rational to be optimistic than pessimistic. If you're a pessimist, what did Madeleine Albright say? She said, a pessimist is an optimist who's been mugged by reality. So I think that we should be rational, but we should also be optimistic. But President Obama used to say this a lot. The arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. No, it can be bent towards justice, which is different.
Yeah.
It won't get there, quote unquote, naturally. It won't get there of its own accord. It'll only get there if all of us, whether you're in the private sector or you're in the NGO sector or you're in government or you're a citizen, the hardest job in the world, Abraham Lincoln said, is to be a citizen. The arc of history has to be bent towards justice.
And that, in a way, is a very interesting return to where we began with the ease with which one can slip into a sort of gloom-laden paralysis or a response that's about action. And what you've been describing is the constitution of somebody for whom action is the right response to that rather than a kind of expectation of inevitability. So thank you.
Thank you.
For that. David, as our listeners will know, we always like to finish each podcast with some rapid-fire questions.
Oh, God. This is where disaster strikes.
Even better. Exactly.
Brace yourself, David.
This is disaster. All my spin doctors will become terrified at this point.
Are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
If you could instantly become an expert in something, what would it be?
I was never very good at science, so anything in the sciences would be interesting. Oh, if I could become an expert at parenting, that would be a good.
Possibly pursuing the empirical method, what is the most unusual thing you've eaten in your travels?
Well, there were some things I ate in China, and I honestly don't know what they were, but I was a bit worried. I mean, I'm very conservative and careful about what I eat when I travel. For older listeners, I still eat bananas, and I find them good for the constitution. I eat a lot of rice when I'm traveling. I'm quite careful about what I eat.
Very sensible. What's one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
Honesty is the best policy. That is such important advice. There was one of the Manchester Cooperative Societies in the 1850s was called something like the Mountie Banks or something. My mother had a mug, I remember, when I was growing up with them. It wasn't the Mountie Banks. It was some other name. And their slogan was, honesty is the best policy. And that sticks with me.
It's been absorbed. What's your favourite way to decompress after a day at work?
Oh, to listen to Louise playing the violin.
And what global leader do you admire most?
Oh, that's very difficult. We're obviously showered with choices at the moment that question. I think we're lucky in the leaders we have at the IMF and the World Bank at the moment. I think they're serious, good leaders. I think Chef Andress is pretty amazing. Every year, I don't understand a word of what they've done, but the scientists who win the Nobel Prize, I mean, there were a group of women scientists who won the Nobel Prize last year in chemistry. Amazing leaders. I think the best answer is in science. That's where the leadership is extraordinary at the moment.
David, it's been fascinating. We've touched on a huge range of subjects, and you have helped us to do some of them justice. So thank you very much indeed for the time.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. Thank you, Hoda.
Thank you so much, David.
David, that was fantastic. Thank you. We covered a lot of ground with you disputing some received wisdom, confirming some of it too. That sense of you as a robust realist really came through strongly. And that bias to action, evidence-based action in your leadership was also really clear. Contrary to one piece of received wisdom, in your view, the arc of history does not bend towards justice automatically, but it can be bent towards it. Culture does not eat strategy for breakfast, in your view, but organizations in the humanitarian space, and indeed in any other, require strategic guidance. They require a plan, and that can work. And those two things allied came through so strongly in everything that you said about the work that you do and the leadership you give. And seeing those who are on the receiving end of humanitarian assistance, not as recipients, but as clients, was also something that came through extremely strongly and something that addresses that question about the legitimacy or otherwise, of organizations in the global north who seek to serve communities and people in the global south. Also, a piece of received wisdom that you do as you say principle, which also runs through that contract that there is between the IRC and the people it serves. And alongside that, your perspective that the talk of deglobalization is somewhat overblown. The world remains a more connected place than it ever has been at any previous time in human history. But the consequence of that is that the volatility of this moment is felt more acutely by all of us than ever before. And I really loved that redefinition of CSR, not as corporate social responsibility, but as corporate social results, something that I think will matter to a lot of the people who listen to this podcast, as will that final summation of the view of the rational optimist, it seems to me, that came through when you quoted a colleague of yours at IRC who said, when I look at the facts and I look at the challenges we face, I am a pessimist when I see the numbers, but I'm an optimist when I see the people. I hope that's true of all of us, and I hope it's true of all of the leaders who listen to this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Redefiners. For more compelling insights from leaders across industries and around the world, listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
To learn more or get in contact with us, follow Redefiners Podcast on Instagram, find Russell Reynolds Associates on LinkedIn, X, and YouTube, and visit our website at russellreynolds.com.